Hi, I'm Alex. This is Six Seasons in a Podcast, the podcast dedicated to the interviews with cast, crew, and writers of the hit comedy community. I'm so glad to be back behind the microphone after a little bit of hiatus. It's been a long, fun year in many ways and a difficult year in other ways. So my guest this week needs no introduction, which in and of itself is an introduction. He's a creator of Community, Rick and Morty, Harmontown, and much more. Dan Harmon, welcome to Six Seasons in a Podcast.
Thank you. It's about time. It takes you long enough to pick up the phone.
Well, thanks so much for being here, and it's nice to know you and then meet you in that order.
Thank you so much. And as I said before we started recording, thank you so much for, you and a handful of people that kind of, that in some cases, literally kept things going from during the entire time, which was important, maybe not in the way that people sometimes think it is, where it's like, oh, Quiznos is out there watching and they'll hear our voice and green light a thing or something. I think the most important thing about it was I was always aware of it. The actors, all of these actors are great and have all worked on a million things, and everybody that works on Community always knows that the fandom is different, and they can compare it to everything else that they work on, and it makes them more liable to it makes them more leverageable to keep doing stuff. No, it makes them emotionally blackmailable. No, I'm kidding. It keeps them invested. I mean, that I think is why it's cool that there are people out there that Instagrammed every day since the last episode of the show aired until yesterday and stuff like that. And this podcast having almost everybody on it. I don't know. Now I'm babbling and you haven't even started the interview, but it also, the cool thing I just wanted to acknowledge, because you're thanking me, I'm saying it also means that every time I see another person from the show, when we run into each other, we get to, it doesn't feel as much like there needs to be that much. It's like they've all done these interviews and stuff, and so it's like we already know that we're all family and that nothing has changed, and that's something that the fans provided us during this lengthy break between the last episode of the show and the movie getting written.
Absolutely. And I love, in my own way, getting to be a part of that has been, an amazing journey for me. The reason I say it is one of the things that I did early on was I invited, Dan, there's literally 15 other Community podcasts out there. And that's not an exaggeration. There's dozens of Community podcasts. And I invited most of them, of the guests, on to join me with the interviews. So Jen from the Community Rewatch podcast, she came on with me to interview Ken, and other folks came on to Jim Rash and those kinds of things. So anyway, I wanted to say that, I've been trying to spread the love for, during this process, and it's been wonderful to get to know these other community, we've had this community that I think is turning into like this nuclear engine to continue to get us to a place where CommuniCon is coming up. Dan, we're talking about doing a CommuniCon, and we love your blessing and love for you to be at that as well.
Yeah. But there hasn't been one every year or anything.
No,
like
they did the three, and now that the movie's being announced, where the engine is chugging along, and there's conversations. So
that sounds great.
Yeah. So we talked about Andrew Guest a little bit. He was one of the first folks to come on the show, and I did an okay job with that. He was so gracious and such a great conversationalist that, other folks came on, Hillary Winston, Zach Paez, and, that's kind of how we get to today. Over the last 3 years, I've had conversations with, 30-plus writers, actors. Stephen Sprung was an editor on the show. He was one of my favorite people to talk to. Just, we had a set carpenter come on and talk about the sets. And, it was an amazing process to get to this moment. And, all of that kind of came to this, bubbled up to the movie announcement last week, or last month rather. And I'd love, for you to talk a little bit, what can you tell us about the movie?
Oh gosh, geez, nothing. I mean, I can, all I can tell you is that a while ago, I sat down for dinner with Andrew Guest to ask him if he would join me on this journey, which didn't include a project really being set up, which meant it was really going to be a journey. And at that time, we didn't even know there was a pandemic coming up, or and it was still gonna, we knew it would still be a slog. The truth is that every day since the show stopped, pretty much there's always been someone out there that's been in conversations about how a movie would happen. And that, as I've expressed in other interviews and stuff, is the that's what makes the movie the hard thing to talk about, is not so much about betraying secrets or anything like that. It's that there's so much there that you can't control, which and certainly including time scale, you can't, you don't, you just don't know what let's do this tomorrow means in this industry. It could very well mean 5 years from now. Tomorrow could also mean next weekend we start shooting. Just kind of it, and it's all so many intersecting variables that are so much larger than anyone's passion or enthusiasm. And and for that reason, it's it makes saying anything about the movie, like, what I learned over time was, like, you may get a little dopamine spike from sharing some good news with people, but then if a year and a half goes by, that feels like a like being the child of an alcoholic or something. It feels like you're getting kind of passively traumatized by somebody, because you then you're going to project onto that, like, does he doesn't care, or nobody cares, and I was stupid to care as a and so anyways, I'm babbling, but it so when I sat down with Andrew, he knew what he was getting into, but, you know, because we had for his the first part of his job was going to be to help me come up with a take on a community movie without knowing how many actors were going to be involved. Part of his job was going to be to start calling actors. Joel came on pretty early to help us accomplish that part of it. I mean, I think probably a not so secret trivia, piece of trivia about the community family is that Joel was really the father figure of the cast, if not the cast and crew, because as high an opinion as I have of myself, I definitely am not, I'm just not a good networker. I'm not a pleasant person to experience. I or rather, even if that's just in my head and I'm a baby, it's like I'm too much of a narcissist and not a people person. And like, it's, I don't have a lot of people's numbers in my phone that I work with. I'm like very kind of, I don't seem it, but I'm introverted. And Joel was always, if we didn't have Joel, then I don't know how you would like rally a cast like that, all of whom are incredibly exceptional people. And it's like, but they all trust Joel, and Joel loves to call people and talk to them and say, let's get something going. He's a natural leader, and that includes me. Like, Joel kind of, like, Joel got my job back, you know. Joel is just that guy. And it's kind of funny because that's Jeff Winger's natural gift as well. Anyways, so it was Andrew, and then Joel kind of, like, we had to, we had to see if anybody was going to be willing to do it tentatively. Then we had to sit around and have regular meetings where Andrew and I just started asking ourselves, what would this thing be? It is such a, it's such an odd question to have to ask after all those years, because the show, you know, the perception of the show, my perception of other people's perception of the show, my perception of the characters within the fourth walls, perception of the show that Abed thought they were on. I don't know where reality begins or ends. The years since stopping Community have been transformative for me. So it's not as easy as just putting my head right back up my butt and having everything be exactly where I left it. and let alone would it be as easy as that to please fans who have grown for 10 years since the show went off the air. Anyway, so it's like you sit there and you go, like, what would the good community movie be? I think it's a lot easier for me to rule stuff out than to tell you what we're kind of pursuing, but
sure.
Because I want people to be part of that conversation. Maybe because I have like anxiety about people thinking that I'm not thinking hard enough about something, or people think, you know, like, so for instance, I go like, do we really think that it would be a good idea for the community movie to be a paintball episode? I think this is one of the first things to kind of rule out, because it's the first thing off the top of your head. And it's that's an issue with the community movie concept, is that we did a lot of episodes where from page one to page 30, you are joyfully locked in a construct that isn't a traditional sitcom narrative, but is in fact rather through the lens of David Fincher or Scorsese, or more importantly, like through the lens of one of the characters' perceptions. And so there was a lot of special episodes that for lack of a better term, and not to be too reductive about it, were kind of like genre homages and things. And the paintball thing was one of them. And we tried to do a bunch more paintballs, and they were all perfectly wonderful things to do. But would anything ever capture ever again the joy of like the original paintball episode, where instead of a genre, really the rule that we were breaking was, holy crap, can a sitcom actually be not only a movie, but a movie that has none of its roots in comedy, and let alone conflict resolution over over a group hug, and then on top of it, that whole it being a that you're running around with guns in a school, which was never a good idea on TV even back then, and like, how can we do that in a way that's acceptable? How can we, so anyways, and then you sit down and write the movie and you're like, so we do that, right? Because it's so emblematic of what made our show special and the triumphs that we had, the things that we contributed as a show, or we'd play Dungeons and Dragons for 90 minutes, or we, and then you kind of got to rule that out. Or maybe I should use my I statements. I got to kind of rule that out. Maybe a better writer wouldn't. That's also a thing that plagues you. You're like, oh my God, we just started this, and it feels like there's 90 bad choices we could make. Because before we even know it, we're going to rule something out that we should have ruled in as a possibility. And that's not how we made the show. Mm-hmm. The paintball episode started with literally with this is how young and kind of passionate about TV and just hanging out with people and talking to them I was back then. It was like, that was a conversation cause, like, what can't we do? And let's just honestly ask it. And almost immediately somebody mentioned school shootings. I don't want to poison the well of the paintball episode, but I think I've mentioned this in interviews, so it's out there. But it's like, that started a hypothetical conversation of like, would it be possible to, does that really just make it mean that we're not allowed to have a gun in our narrative or anything like that? And then that very quickly, the thing stopped being about it having anything to do with gun violence or school shootings. It just started as a sort of academic platonic conversation, but then very quickly just became like, holy crap, let's pretend that we never deserved a TV show, let's and for good reason, and let's just make like this apocalyptic action adventure movie, and how do we do that? And in a world where episodes like that are so classic, that resulted in lateral thought on the, by people that loved the show so much that they slept in their offices. God, that's the first anxiety that seizes me, as I go, okay, so even following a path of rationality and thinking like a traditional producer, going like, okay, what, even the thought, what do people want, could be the wrong thought. And then I start to tailspin into, am I overthinking or underthinking and all that stuff. So that Andrew Guest knew that that's the journey that he was being brought on. And so people need to give him a medal for being willing to do that. I think that, but unfortunately what I can't do is then tell you like, well, here's what we decided to do. I think it's easy enough to say, we came around to the healthy wisdom, which is we have to make sure that this movie, that its premise alone doesn't prohibit a pretty long list of things that you might want to get out of a community movie. I could riff some examples of like things that I think would be a bad way to get started on a community movie premise. One would be like, Greendale Community College has been closed down for 10 years. And that'd be an easy, natural thing, because right, what you know, it'd be like, oh, the campus is the show. The show's been off the air. Okay, great. But now, are you going to spend your movie painting and fixing windows and in abandoned hallways, without students going to and fro? I think that a huge part of returning to community that the average lover of community would want to feel is that Greendale is a place, and that it is. And that includes daylight and class schedules and lockers and backpacks and background actors and faculty, you know, functioning as an institution. So you're not going to do anything terribly clever with the school, you know, using the school's demise or resurrection or anything like that as a device, because you don't want too much of your movie to be spent unrecognizable. Then you get in all these questions of like, do you want to watch, if you do a Gilligan's Island reunion, do you want, how much of you wants to see Ginger and Marianne and the professor forced to wear the same outfits that they wore on Gilligan's Island, even though they've aged a little bit, and the time has changed, and how much of you conversely wants to look at the professor not dressed like the professor? I use that very reductive example of like you can imagine, like when I refer to them wearing things, you can imagine I mean also, though, do you want the professor to not be smart in the Gilligan's Island reunion? Do you want him do you want the bit to be like, it's like a Fat Thor bit, like where, oh, the professor's the dumbest guy in the world because Gilligan's Island, they got off the island and Silicon Valley had happened, so now the professor's an idiot. Ha ha. The answer is, therein lies the answer that, you know, the sweet spot that we ended up going through philosophically was, aha, you know what everybody likes to see? Is that time has changed, and so have the lives and the characters and the world and that we all share with them. But the character has adapted, they've reacted to a changing world the same as we all have, but they are unmistakably themselves, and that might and so trying to figure that out. We were sort of like, you know, at its heart, like what we looked at the idea that the Breakfast Club was like obviously a huge inspiration on me for writing the pilot, and the fact that there's a big relationship between the Breakfast Club and the Big Chill, and for those kids out there, you know, that they probably heard that title a million times. And
I was just Googling The Big Chill because I was going to pitch, you know, you can always get Joel to behave if you could pitch that we're going to do a Big Chill movie. And, you know, it's all about Joel being dead.
Well, there's that, yeah, that whole story of like how Leonard Nimoy only agreed to do Star Trek. Was it which Star Trek movie was it? If they killed Spock at the end of it, or there are movies, there are stories that are about groups of people getting together that then have to cope with concrete manifestations of the fact that a certain amount of time has gone by, and Andrew was the first to point out that even though it's only been 10 years since Community, and I know I keep using that phrase and it's probably more like 9 or 11 and I can't keep track, but it's roughly a decade. But Andrew was the first to point out that one of the things that's changed so much about our world is that 10 years in our 10 years of our time is 30 years of big chill time. Culturally, it's and not because we're so sophisticated, it's just because obviously because technology allowed it catalyzed every effect that you usually have with the passage of time. The whole point of the big chill is just like they haven't seen each other in 30 years or whatever it's been, and one guy never really realized how much money the other guy made selling shoes, and it's like, well, that would never happen nowadays because we all blithely keep up to date on each other's outward facing lives on Facebook. But the other aspect of that is that we're all also over the last 10 years are learning that in a world where our outward facing lives are online, are the actual us, and we can be hired and fired based on it. We can ruin our family's lives by having said the wrong thing at this or that time. We're media has become our normal life, and it has increasingly made that life less and less familiar to us. So there, it wouldn't even be outlandish to suggest that enough time's gone by in Community that the world and not these characters has actually changed so significantly that there's a lot to deal with. And that they haven't been together in a long time, but it's not because they swore each other off. We've already told that story. You know, they swore Greendale off, et cetera, but there's a reason to get together. And then there's a reason they have to stay together. And from that, you grow, then I think everything that you want to see in a Community movie happens in layers. And that you don't want to, with that premise, go so crazy that, and so specific that you end up screwing yourself by going, oh, well, it turns out, one of my big things is like, we have to avoid a situation where the movie is going to take place all in one night. Because then this is a TV show. It was a part of people's lives. It's like, you don't want the MASH reunion to be, you go back and there's a power outage at the 4077th. And so they spend the entire MASH movie trying to get the power back on, and there's no Korean War, and there's no soldiers coming in on helicopters that need to be patched up. And there's no need for Alan Alda to try to cut through it with acerbic wit that's hiding a deep pain. You're losing everything because you grabbed this premise. You're like, oh, what a great idea. You apologized. Your listeners should know Alex starts the recording session by making sure everybody knows that he doesn't like his ability to speak, and I'm like, and then he's like, oh, I like to get other people to talk, and I'm like, boy, careful what you wish for. And also, no wonder you're a fan of mine. I've never been able to talk ever in my life without running everything into the ground. I've been answering, I don't even remember what question. Yep. And what am I talking about? No, oh, I remember you asked can you tell us what's in the movie? And I said no. And then I tried to kind of circumscribe, because what I want people to understand, and I truly believe that our fans are the one fan base that you could have a kind of a rational connection with us about, where you could be like, I mean, because if it is crazy to me how thoughtful how empathic community fans are as a rule. Everybody's nuts. We're all crazy, but it's kind of weird to have a fan base that's all of the community fans are crazy in a way that involves connection with each other. Yeah. Like, no, there's not a big community faction that's like, I'm here to represent the people that don't give a shit about anybody but themselves. And what happened to that? What happened to those episodes? And what happened to that? Like, what about the fan that loves community because he hates people? Anyways, I never want to disappoint these people. And it's also why I feel like if I can babble at them enough, maybe in a podcast interview, and say, hey, do you know how much thought you might put into a community movie at the very beginning, as far as like, oh, what's the premise going to be? Like, what's the founding kind of the foundational conceit going to have to be to make sure that we're set up for success? I would hope that they would go, oh yeah, that would be a real humdinger of a gig. And I bet you thought about it a lot, and I bet you deferred to a lot of, I bet you didn't even assume that you knew what you were talking about and checked with some of the smartest people in the world about it. And even if you end up wrong, I believe you, Dan Harmon, because I'm a community fan, which means my heart bleeds instead of beating.
Do not apologize once for how you answer questions. It is exactly what I'm looking for. You notice that I affirm, but I don't. I try not to interrupt because I just every once in a while I'll have something that I want to add. But you know, the only thing is, I'm not sure how Hollywood works. So I apologize if you're not allowed to hear pitches. But the only thing that I will say is, I would love if Britta is a pet psychologist. That's all I'm saying. I just think that would be brilliant for Britta. Anyway, I don't know how that works. If you're not allowed to hear pitches, but.
I guess the reason I'm not supposed to hear him is because then later you could, if Britta was a pet psychologist.
Now she can't be, damn it.
And then there's also like, oh, even if she's just a psychologist, then you could decide later that because you pitched pet psychologist that was your idea. And so lawyers say, therefore you can never hear anything from anybody here, read anything, but I'll run it up the flagpole, my man. Do you think she'd be good at it or bad at it?
Well, here's what I feel. And this is my big feeling about, I think they're all successful after they graduate. I think they all go on to do something great because when they're together, they're perfect with each other, but they're also hold each other back. But when they also need each other, when they're away from each other, so they can be successful, from a professional perspective, but somehow relationally they need each other. I just think there's, anyway, that's not very elegant, but
those are no. I mean, you're not. I would bother to disagree with you and go. Because if I was like, oh man, he's thinking so much differently about this than I am, that he must represent a huge portion of the audience. And now that I know I'm going to disappoint them, I'm going to push back on this while I have a chance. But I'm relieved to hear that. There's a fundamental agreement there about the philosophy of that. Yes. Like, we've already done this story. That was a big bump for me. Is that when we did the, I really liked the kind of quote unquote repiloting. That's what we felt like we had to do or wanted to do, was like, okay, let's jettison the Jeff Winger needs a 4-year degree and one day is going to atone with his father for real and et cetera, et cetera. Like, we got interrupted in that story. Let's not circle back and retcon it or do anything like that. Let's start a new show about a lawyer who thinks he's a bad guy, but is probably a better guy than he thinks, who is once again getting together with a group of people that he has every reason to think are going to kind of drag him down in his quest for what he thinks he deserves, et cetera. We really just changed the circumstances and started the show over again and started calling it the Save Greendale Committee instead of a study group. The big kryptonite of that was sort of like, oh crap, how, to what extent do we not, do we want to avoid bumping with that story? In other words, for instance, like we, in that story, part of the gimmick was that, almost the opposite of what you described, which is that everybody was in a great deal of denial about how they're, how they've prospered and how they're healthy and happy. And they're all actually lying about it. Parentheses, because they need each other so badly. That's the similar thing. I mean, and it's like, yeah, let's not do that again. I mean, even on some unconscious level, you're like, yeah, we've already told this story. And we've told it a couple times too, where it's like Greendale is the place that we thought sucked, but we're going to slowly learn it's great by the end of the story. There's a bunch of stuff that it's like, just because we had to do hundreds and hundreds of episodes. All right, Dan, don't get hyperbolic. You did 112 or something. It was a boot camp for telling three act stories about people and their relationship with each other in a community college. So you don't want to be a refusenik about that. If you can't bump with any of those episodes, emotional arcs, then what are we going to do? Have them start a dog kennel together and have their memories wiped at the beginning of the episode. But at the same time, you don't want to just kind of do something like, didn't they do this in an episode already? Don't these people, I always call that out when I see movies and stuff where I'm like, it bugs me a little bit if I'm invested in a character a great deal, I'd like to think that all of the hours that I've logged being familiar with the changes they've gone through they match up with your ledger as a storyteller. I don't need you to be as obsessed with the show as I am as a fan, but I don't want you to just say, because it helps you tell a story quicker or easier, that so-and-so is allergic to peanuts and not cheese, like you said they were. and if they were allergic to cheese and they had an episode where they went to the hospital and they had a near-death experience and the whole arc was about them coping with their atheism or their belief in an afterlife or death itself, I'm sorry, but that character in your movie, I'm going to be really annoyed if they're walking around going, well, you all know me, I don't believe in death, or I'm like, well, yeah, but Indy, you saw rocks glow, you met, I just remember that the Indiana Jones trailer, he's like, I don't believe in magic, and I'm like, all right, that better be only part of a dialogue. that's a big challenge right there. A worthwhile one, a truly worthwhile one, because that's when we say in the writer's room, we go, this is an offer, not a hole. When you're saying something from a position of negativity, but it's not because you're trying to convince the room to give up on something. It's because you want to explore it more. The fact that it feels like there's things here that are creatively challenging to us is not, it's not to say that it's that we should give up and work in a different direction. It's to say, oh, there's a shot here on this billiard table that actually is going to involve a few bumps, and it's the way to win the game, possibly. Let's explore which two balls we're trying to avoid hitting, as we, because that might be the direct path to the corner pocket. My metaphors are the worst. Even within that one, I switched from multiple bumpers to a straight shot into a pocket. It's like, it's insane. But it's okay, because I'm in an interview with a guy that he has a rule that he refuses to interrupt me and say, you sound like a crazy person, stop talking. And it's going to be the greatest thing that ever happened to me. I'm going to finally be revealed to be a great interview subject. I just needed latitude. It's all I ever needed.
That's what you needed.
I just needed a microphone and time to talk. And yeah.
Well, I really just want Harmontown back. So if I can just replicate some Harmontown, I'm happy with that. We can move on from the movie. I know that there's only so much you can say at this point, and only so much you should say, so that we are excited. Because if you were to tell us everything, it would come and we would be disappointed, I guess. Or maybe not. I don't know how eating too many pieces of candy before Easter, how that works. But that's my bad metaphor. I think that's really helpful. I'm glad we talked about that. Thank you so much for sharing about what you can about the movie. I'm really excited about it. Is there anything particular that you're really excited about to do with the movie? I mean, get the Avengers back together.
Well, I mean, I'm really just, I think the top of the list is, I am excited to watch these actors live and breathe on camera again. I've been working in animation almost exclusively the entire time since. And there's a ton of things that make animation so much more effective and convenient. Then there's a bunch of things that just you're like, holy crap. And working in a medium where I can literally decide in a sound mix that a character's head should be shaped differently, and there's feasibly still time to make their head different, let alone change where their eyeballs are going, and also since all of the characters in animation are technically ADR, they can, if there's an emergency, you can even rewrite the script in the last minute. It's not advisable, and it's not altogether, but from a technological standpoint, the medium allows for that. You could be like, I'm going to jump on this microphone and say, I like biscuits instead of I like spinach. And this character is now going to like biscuits, even though the actor is in Tahiti and we, et cetera. So the amazing thing is what you don't have, though. You don't have in the edit bay, a dozen takes from different angles of, Alison Brie and Joel McHale, approaching an exchange between two characters in subtly different ways that in combination, can create the feeling of being a ghost in a room with two living people that truly have a life of their own. Because unlike in animation, as much as the voice actor can do to bring their own personality to a character, there's just so much about that character that's completely controlled by things that aren't the actor. Whereas the actor has so much more power in live action that that can result in some really amazing things. And I desperately miss that. I miss just, I was never like a guy that was like, I never felt like I was a net gain or loss on the set. I always felt like at the end of the day, I'm going to make just as many wrong choices if I'm down on the set, getting under the director's feet and confusing the actors. I felt like it was like 50-50. Maybe if I'm down there, thank God I was down there, because then they didn't have to do as many takes because I was a help. But for every one moment like that, there was probably others where I made people do 20 takes of something because I thought something was important that I was later going to change my mind on, or I was just wrong. I just didn't, and so I always felt like where you can, so I'll stay in the writer's room and, I don't need to pal around and like micromanage the way people do their lines. And for that reason, it's all the more amazing when I think about how alive these characters already were when they came to me in the post-production process, the crazy gift that was, where you're getting a box for every episode full of a bunch of collaborators who are. And look at that cast when you look at everything that they do separately. I mean, yeah. I really don't want to express love in a negative way, but it's just like, how can you not compare that cast to any other cast, you know, and go like, wow, that's quite an ensemble of performers, like where each of them it has this full toolkit of subtle expressions and intonations and things where they working that well in combination. I mean, there's no mistaking now that I'm confident that I'm good at whatever I'm good at, and I don't have to take credit for Community as a whole, you know, megalomaniacally. Now it's all the easier to look back and go, holy crap, what an ensemble. And it seems like a corny answer, but truly that's one of the first things I look forward to is it's been so long since I've had front row seats to to a bunch of people that I can just I get to just like write my typical long-winded, you know, overwrought, head up the butt scenes. And then I get to change them. And then and then ultimately I get to edit them down even more. And it's such a great, it's the live actors support that, support my writing a lot better than people that I get to tell someone to draw. Because they just breathe life into these things, and then I can go, oh right, my job isn't that difficult here. I and it actually allows me to like focus on stuff like oh, let's fill this with jokes. Does anyone know a joke writer? Come help me make this funny.
Yeah. Well, speaking of people, I as I said, I've talked to 30 plus different people from the show, and you know. Without exception, every single person has been wonderful to me. I'm just really curious, you know, when you're selecting writers, you know, when you're building this culture, like there's got to be something to how you made this show special, you know, and all of these folks that were, you know, so nice and so and just so kind and to this day love this show to the point that they do. So there's a question in there somewhere, but you know, was there an intentionality to, you know, who you were selecting as writers?
Yeah, definitely. I for the first season, second season, at a minimum. I mean, I was obsessive about it because I thought, well, if I have one job, and am therefore not allowed to complain if this gate isn't kept, then I'm done before I started. So I used to sit there with piles of scripts, and my big thing was, I want to see a spec script for an existing show that you wrote. And I want to see a spec script of an original, both because that's the two equally sized leaves of the jobs table is on one hand, it's not your show.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, it's going to be story driven. So I just, you know, and different strengths would get displayed in different aspects. It's like somebody, one writer might, by writing a Modern Family spec, a writer might reveal, an incredible agility, for setup punchline kind of comedy writing that, ironically, they actually don't put on full display when they burden themselves with creating an immersive narrative of their own. It is a curious kind of irony of the comedy writer mindset that we tend to to the extent that we worship at the altar of comedy a lot. You know, we're very averse to pretense. Because you can't write good comedy if you are trying to prove something about yourself. You can't write good comedy if you have an agenda beyond writing good comedy. And therefore, there is a sort of traditional disconnect between somebody who's a really good comedy writer and somebody who would therefore dare to say, plus, I want you to care about these people. And therefore, somebody might therefore be able to say it because they're writing a Modern Family and they can be above the task because the show's been created and it's not even a show they're trying to get a job on. They're just using that show's format. Now they're free to go set up punchline, set up punchline, set up punchline. And maybe the character arcs aren't that great in that spec script. And then over here is this crazy pilot they created that never sold, but is an example of them being at the helm of a blank universe. And it's possible that in that script they might be relatively bland in their comedy, because what are they doing? They're showing their sentimental side, so they're trying to detach what they actually consider their Jedi powers from it, because the two compete. And for the exact same reason, it may also be flipped. Their Modern Family spec might actually show nothing but their facility for structure, because for the same inversion. And then in their pilot, they might be going hog wild with these super edgy, really funny jokes. And the whole thing might be an exercise in can't trust this person to immerse an audience because they have no respect for anything but being funny. And and their sample script is therefore a mishmash of really funny jokes and a narrative that's completely linear. The combination of the two is what needs to be there, or what needed to be there for me back in the day. But because and you never knew, you know, because I would use both. I would say, well, on one hand, this person's a really good joke writer when they feel like that's their job on someone else's show. And on the other hand, they kind of suck at understanding what a show requires to do in terms of like making people respect the characters. But you never knew like what would be on display where. It was just sort of like, I liked seeing the two sides to them. Because it's hard to run a room full of incredibly smart, funny people, especially back then when I wasn't an old man that, you know, talking to a bunch of young people who, you know, it was much harder back then. Or you're like, a lot of these people have worked longer than I have on shows that are successful and are rightfully asking themselves, why am I their boss? And so it's all the harder than to then sit in a room full of, you know, it's like, imagine, I mean, like going into the Onion and being like a guest Onion editor, like, and you're just like, okay, here I am, like that kind of intimidation that comes with comedy stuff. I don't want to have to think while I'm talking to those people that they're rolling their eyes at me. Which is why, in a very self-serving way, I was always looking for sentimentality. Like, I wanted the most talented people I could get, but I needed them to have feelings I could exploit and count on to not mock me when I asked them to help me make people cry a little bit. Because we were never going to be as funny as 30 Rock. I always said, my joke, but there's a lot of truth to it, was that I was like, we're never going to win a 30 Rock contest with 30 Rock. So like 30 Rock's just funny from beginning to end. What if we were just almost as funny as 30 Rock, but then like for 20% of it, we had like, you know, you were sad like then we can win a first place contest with ourselves, you know, and have our own flavor. And that's a cynical way. It's not like I actually, but it's like that's how I saw my job. That's how I continue to see it. It's like, I'm not one of these guys that's like, comedy is so important that everything that gets in the way of it is bullshit. I'm like, have you ever tried to watch 25 minutes of setups and punchlines? There's a really good chance that it took an incredibly charismatic human being and several glasses of water in front of a gigantic arena full of people in order for you to buy into the idea that nothing but comedy can get you through more than a couple minutes. Doesn't everybody out there have a friend who's always on and that you kind of wish would reveal that they had fears and things like that, you know? To answer your question in the longest way possible, yeah, I was always like looking for the two sides of the coin, because I didn't want to get made fun of in the writer's room, and I didn't want to be alone in trying to have the third act of these sitcom episodes feel like the way I used to feel when I would watch Cheers and things, like, where you felt rewarded for believing that the characters were real, instead of getting slapped in the face going like, you know, that the internet brought with it the ability for a TV viewer to find out that they might be alone in taking their favorite TV show too seriously. Conversely, they could also find out they were very much not alone, but it just like adds a whole new layer. You could get debunked for insisting that Big Bang Theory was deeply moving that week. You might accidentally get on Reddit and have somebody say, oh no, that episode was meh and that writer sucks and I prefer this and they're just following this formula. Like, that Cheers wasn't subjected to that, therefore, like, and it's like, you want people to feel that way though. You want them to feel like, oh my God, I just watched something wonderful. In order to do that, you have to gain their trust that you don't need to do that. And you also have to then figure out how to somehow like put people through these changes at the end of the story where it's like, yeah, but you need to, then not too much can change. You need to use the same set. But you got to be convinced that you watched something happen that was transformative.
Yeah. When you're creating characters like Abed, for instance, do you take in consideration where they're going? I mean, how much of a story arc do you know you have in place for that character? Do you have a purpose for each character? You know, what goes into writing characters?
For characters, I always looked at it like characters need to run like an organelle instead of a cell, or a piece of an engine instead of the whole engine. That the character needs to be designed for long-term abuse. The character needs to be simple and rugged. Like, it needs to not be composed of principles that wear out over time. So I always use the example of Annie because she's the easiest one. Annie has a core to her character that is, she's driven. And I wanted to make sure, it's like, well, we can't have a neat freak in our ensemble. We can have someone that maybe represents that role in this episode across this season, because if you're driven, maybe that manifests itself as you being a neat freak. But the neat freak thing, those things change, and they especially get challenged by dramatic stories where you're interacting with other people. Being a neat freak is the kind of thing an arc can knock right out. Otherwise, it's not going to be that satisfying to watch the story. Because, like, I mean, me caring where everything goes, it's either pathological and therefore not really part of a character. It's part of a disease. And that's why it can't change. Or it's a thing that isn't ever challenged. And that's important to look at. Like, oh, no one's ever questioning that I'm a neat freak, maybe because I'm a high functioning neat freak. But most importantly, like, it's the kind of thing that you might suspend because of something that happens to you. Mm-hmm. If you're a neat freak and your father dies, and you get in a fight with your uncle at the funeral, and it's got themes to it of you needing to control the universe, like, the best way to show that you went through something that and changed is for you at the end to allow someone to not use a coaster. And then now if your character was only ever a neat freak, now you're really fucked because you just did a great episode and your reward is that you either have to retcon and send the audience a signal that the character was never really alive. They're a simulacrum and they're going to reboot now. You're in Westworld and they're not real. You're going to have to start, doing motorcycle jumps in order to keep the audience invested because now they're a neat freak. And with Annie is kind of a neat freak. And, but she also had a nervous breakdown. She also might be the opposite of a neat freak because she's like a neat freak might be a person that might, maybe the reason they're a neat freak is because they live in terror of like the fact that they're going to be this other thing and that's more within reach for them. Maybe Annie has more of a capacity to be a slob than even a normal lazy person. And the important thing is to get down to the core of that. And my game I always play is what's the one word like, and how short can that word be while still being different enough from all the other words in an ensemble so that there's not too much overlap, but there's always a little bit and that all of those parts that are designed for long-term abuse, they all then you put them into an engine that you're like, it's not going to break down. The individual parts are going to go chug, 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 chug. Cause Annie's driven. And is there an episode that says, well, what if driven Annie was driven to be a hippie this episode? What if she was driven to be a slob? What if she was driven to be romantic? What if she was driven to try to not be as driven? I mean, the answer to that one, I guess, should be careful and tell an episode that, hey, Annie, I know you like to control everything, but you're not going to be able to control whether you're controlling. And you actually just need to forgive yourself for that part and reaffirm that and say, Annie's always going to be driven. The audience doesn't need to know that that's the word. And people always want to know, what are the other seven words? Like, give me the breakdown. And I'm like, well, I don't even know that I know them all. But it's like, Annie makes the easy example, and I do think that's characters need to have a core. The core needs to be not something so, it needs to be timeless, and it needs to be something that you truly believe as a storyteller is the kind of thing about a human that can be innate. And that's a really challenging thing for us as humans because we love the idea that everyone can change and we should believe that. We shouldn't. So that challenges you to come up with something really deep. And also it makes you not judge the characters. Because if you want people to be able to change, you're not going to say that someone's just racist. that's the core of their character. Well, they're just one of those people that's just racist when they're born and God love them. They're never going to change. Like, we don't like that. And it's bad craft. And that's a great thing about character creation is that it forces you as a writer to realize that you shouldn't have any characters that are just fodder that you're writing down to that because you think you're so above them and they I like to start with like people that fascinate me in my real life and then I break those people down into as tiny beads as I can, where I go, and then I ask myself, which of those beads are similar to other people's? So if I have when I was creating the community characters, I went through my cell phone and I would just take note of any names that created a spark for me, good or bad or whatever. Not necessarily, oh, I'm so intimate with that person to know them so well, but just like another example, I've used frequently because it's an easy example. It's like I had an ex-girlfriend whose father's name was in my phone. And when the father's name came up, that it ended up, I didn't know at the time, but it ended up becoming a big part of Pierce. Not all the parts. There were other parts, like there's parts of Pierce that are based on my fascination with the now departed Sam Simon from Simpsons and television history, like, who was an incredibly wealthy, but by most accounts, like kind of a really self-loathing guy, but with a heart of gold that I had the pleasure of talking to a lot and anyways, but it was like, so what are the little beads that fascinate me about Sam Simon? And then what are the beads that are fascinating me about this ex-girlfriend's father? Not knowing that they're going to be the same, but first just going, where are these beads, these little bits, these things that you say? It's so weird when someone in the world is like this, and then you break it down as much as you can. And then if I know, I go like, oh, it's weird that Sam Simon has that aspect, and so does this random guy that Sam Simon would never know or care about, and that it wouldn't normally put in the same category, because they're not both TV producers, nor are they both my ex-girlfriend's father, nor are they both, I don't have any kind of judgment on either of them in a hierarchical thing, but here's this thing. And then when you see that they're the same thing, then you start to force yourself into an academic conversation about what is that? What am I identifying? And then from there you might go, who else do I know that has that? And what are the parts of them that aren't related to that? Strip them away, et cetera. So it's it's like coming up with these, God, what a conversation you uncorked. but yeah, it's about finding those cores.
Yeah.
And then if they're based on that, then so I was never, I think another important answer to your question is no, I do not. Story is a different thing. So another better writer might do the opposite of this, but I never, narrative, is not an important part of character creation for me. There are people that will tell you, like, it's all about like writing the biography of the character, like what happened to them, where were they born, and all this stuff. And those same people might tell you that then they therefore forecast like a path for that character to follow, like from the creation of the show onward. I know where this person's been, and therefore I know where I want them to go and how they're going to intersect and how that's going to involve the other characters. Kudos to those people, but like I'm too phobic about getting painted in corners and ultimately failing to do homework that I just don't. I'd rather like try to design a machine that can withstand unpredictable circumstances and start to do different tasks as you change your mind and as you work with other people. So like, you know, community. Yeah, that was always my like kind of obsession about that, character versus plot and episodes and stories and stuff. Like,
so I guess maybe we'll land on this one. Why do you think community continues to resonate with audiences?
I think that it's because of some of the stuff that I mentioned here that alludes to the idea that you need to make sure the audience never feels punished for their obsessiveness, their immersion. And the show was always designed like that from the ground up, because I just felt like that was my minimal job, was to provide people with a show that would never say, you think about this show a lot, you're crazy. So there's that. I think that's the most fundamental reason. It may be the least romantic, because it's really just a structural answer, which is like, I designed it that way. I wanted people to feel like you're allowed to think about the show a lot. Therefore, I thought about it a lot. And so it feels, even if it's an illusion, it feels like it's a place that you can walk around and put your coffee down and have a good time. And I think there's other answers to that, which are like, the fucking actors are amazing, et cetera. They're probably like less fun. I also think that it's about humans over systems. And I think that even though it's warm and not like edgy and cynical, it also feels subversive, in a way that is good. Like the way chicken soup feels subversive, against a virus. I think that might be why the Netflix kids were able to get into it. Who knows though? My niece and nephew are 7 and 9, and they they're obsessed with Friends, and I watched Friends with them, and I was like, oh, time plus TV makes everything for kids. Joey is so well crafted in his Joeyness that he may as well be like an Ice Capades character to them, that they're like, well, they're, because their parents are watching Euphoria or something, and if they tried to watch that, they'd be like, I don't understand what's going on and what a character is, because that showrunner needs to explore nuance and depth. And so even though Friends was for adults, now the 7 and 9 year old, they're like, thank God this was crafted so well that now I understand when he enters and what his catchphrase is and what his relationship with the world is. How did I start on that fucking crap? Oh, that's I think there was a whole generation of Netflix viewers who I perceived were pretty young, that were just like, this show slaps, you know. And I think it's just because the show was bingeable. And because we didn't retcon, we didn't reveal along the way that the show, it's like, I think that makes it really binge worthy. And that while you're binging it, you don't feel gradually toxified or numbed. That's a big thing. Like, we use TV to medicate, and Community is no exception, but I think Community is intentionally flavored medicine that tastes a little healthier than just like, oh my God, these characters can't stand their job and they keep showing up for work. And yes, that's how I feel too. And I'm going to lose myself in this because I don't want to think about the breakup that I just went through or losing my father. And like you can feel that way. And then also it's like the difference between like a medicine that makes you feel like kind of like your head's in a vice, but it takes away your sore throat, versus like, you know, something that like actually makes you feel more alive. That's another reason. That's the emotional reason. I think the long-term effects of mass consumption of Community don't make you feel like you smoked a pack of cigarettes.
Well, I'm terrible at goodbyes, but I just want to thank you so much for being on Six Seasons in a Podcast, Dan. You've been wonderful. We learned so much, and I just really appreciate your time.